I'm Dr. Leif Tappanilla from the Idaho Museum of Natural History. I'm here with Peter Pruitt from Zoo Idaho. This is The Nature of Idaho. Coming from the 1B, we're talking all about Idaho, its wild places and wild faces, the natural setting that makes Idaho an incredible place to live and be proud of. Today, our guest is the Outdoor Recreation Supervisor for the City of Pocatello Parks and Recreation Department, Lance Clark, and we'll be talking about rafting in Idaho.
First, though, let's get into a bit of nature news, Leif. 85% of the universe is made up of dark matter, and 15% is ordinary matter. And this is the stuff that's made of protons, neutrons, electrons, things that we can see, stuff that makes stuff. Of that 15% of matter, 10% is found in galaxies, 60% is found in diffuse gas clouds, and about 30% has been lost.
What do you mean lost?
It's just lost. Scientists and astronomers had no idea where this 30% of ordinary matter was.
30%, that's a lot. Okay, but we know now.
One-third of the matter has been lost. Well, they think they've found it, or at least they're getting closer to finding where it is. And it's been due to a team of international scientists from Rome, the Netherlands, Mexico, and the U.S., and what they used to be calling a massive cosmic annoyance is now turning into a massive cosmic discovery. They're theorizing that this missing matter is hidden in stringy filaments of warm, hot intergalactic medium, or WIM.
Warm, hot intergalactic what?
Medium.
Medium.
So wow. It's these little ethereal tendrils that you kind of see out in the universe, just these almost like clouds in a sense, cloud waves or streams. And when they found this, it kind of gave credence to a lot of these scientists' theories and hypotheses on how galaxies are formed and how these structures, like our planets, form too. And it's really kind of nice that they've found or are close to finding that missing 30%.
Well, that's good news, because who wants to be lost? 30%, that's an incredible amount.
Well, yeah. No one wants to go through life being lost a third of their time.
We're always looking to the stars to find out what our future is all about. But back here on Earth, you know, there's lots of good things to do here. Today, I'm pretty excited to learn more about rivers and what we can do with them. I think that'd be a lot of fun. You know, today, our trivia question is all about whitewater river mileage. So we're going to ask, in a previous show, in fact, we talked about how many rivers there are in Idaho, and we're kind of proud that we have over 100,000 miles of river in Idaho. Well, today's trivia question is, how many of those river miles are whitewater class? And today we're going to talk all about rafting. So after the break, we're going to introduce our guest today, Lance. But first, let's hear a little word from our sponsor.
Try streaming our signal at KISU.org, or simply tell your Amazon or Google smart speaker to play KISU. Remember, even when our FM signal is out, KISU continues streaming live online.
And we're back. Today, I really want to thank Lance for being here today, and he's here to talk to us all about rivers and how we can raft on them. First off, Lance, how did you get into rafting rivers?
My introduction to rivers was through my uncle, and he was a big whitewater rafter, and when I was a kid, he would just invite me and my brothers and my mom, kind of a family rafting trip. He'd go up on the Snake River by Jackson Hole for some long weekends, and we'd just run up for a day, and he'd take us down. And then it got serious when I was 12, he got a rafting permit on the main Salmon River, and in an act of unparalleled generosity, he invited my older brother, myself, my dad, my uncle, my grandpa, and then a raft full of his friends. I ended up on the Salmon River when I was 12, and he kind of taught me to row a little bit on that trip, and basically, as soon as I could drive, I started renting rafts and going out on my own and leading groups.
So with rafting, the rapids have certain categories.
Mm-hmm.
How old were you when you hit one of your most challenging categories? And really, what are the categories?
So, the rapids are graded 1 through 6, 1 being defined as passable in a canoe, 2 being... it could swamp an open canoe, but if you tip over, you can generally self-rescue without harm. Grade 3 would be large but regular waves or rapids. They could splash over a raft. If hit incorrectly, they could swamp or tip a raft. Grade 3 is what you generally do a commercial trip on. If you pay to do whitewater in Jackson Hole or Glacier, Montana or wherever, it's generally grade 3. So grade or class 4 has irregular waves, and you have to maneuver within the rapid. In other words, you're in the middle of some craziness, and you have to get from left to right, or bad things happen. In class 4, if you take a swim, it's usually violent, extended, and can cause you some harm. Class 5 is the hardest difficulty that is rafted, or kayaked, or anything is navigated. Class 5 is marked by extremely violent and irregular rapids and obstacles that require a move that we call must make. In other words, if you don't make it from left to right by this point, there's a good chance you die. You know, if you take a swim, if you fall out of the boat, you know, or out of, if you flip in your kayak and you're able to right yourself in class 5 whitewater, your life is at risk. There's a good chance you're going to be severely injured, and the only chance of rescue you have is a team of basically highly competent, experienced people around you. You're moving so fast that if somebody's on shore with a rope and they throw you that rope, you're probably going to just pull them into the river with you. There's very little that can be done from shore, and somebody in a kayak that's chasing you down, you're going to be able to grab their kayak and hold on, but they have to be, you know, another level entirely of boater, because they're probably on the edge too of control, if that makes sense. So class 5 is experts only terrain. It is not guided ever. If somebody says they've been on a class 5 guided trip, they are incorrect.
Did you say there was a 6th?
So grade 6 is unrunnable. So something that even to an expert, it's a coin flip to survive, if that makes sense.
Is it obvious by looking at the stretch of river what class it is, or does someone have to run it in order to really know?
To an experienced person, you can immediately look at something and say, that's class 5, that's class 4, that's class 3. So class 3 can be big waves, but they're regular. They're rolly, and there's a clear line where you can see, okay, I'm going to go right down the middle of that. It's going to spit me out. A class 5 rapid to the casual observer just doesn't look runnable. It just looks like doom.
So have you gone on a class 5?
Certainly.
Okay. So with that, my next question is, how long did you scout that section out before you actually ran it?
It has varied quite a bit. There have been sections that I've been scouting out for the last 10 years I still haven't done. And there have been class 5 sections where I've felt good about my skills on that day. I've felt good about my team. And 10 minutes was enough to figure out the line, figure out the order, figure out the safety spots, and go send it.
What I like, Leif, is he said my team. So when he's getting up into these 4 and 5s, people know what he's doing and where he's at. And he's got a group around him. So this isn't something that you just wake up in the morning and say, hey, I'm going to go make this run today because I feel like it.
No. you know, I have done some solo boating, but not at class five. It's just, it's something where the stars have to align. You have to feel comfortable with who you're with. You have to feel comfortable of your skills on that day. You have to feel comfortable with the particular water level, because that affects the difficulty significantly. And sometimes the lines even move around depending on different flows. So class five is not something to take lightly or just hop in and do. It's definitely a team sport at that point.
So I probably is the only guy in the room who has not gone rafting.
I've gone once with Lance. Gone and once. I think he told me I hit a 0.5.
I grew up in the land of slack water, and so I've canoed and kayaked a lot in still water. But what are some of the obstacles that you're facing once you get on the water? Obviously, I could think of rocks being in the way, but what are some of the more subtle things that you have to be aware of and negotiate as you're going through this?
Yeah, probably the number one thing is rocks. Rocks form the channel and all the obstacles in it typically. The exceptions would be logs. Logs or any type of wood or debris are extremely dangerous because they form what's called a strainer, which is kind of self-explanatory, right? The water rushes through a branch or a tree or a series of logs, and the water can fit through, but your body cannot. So you could be held against the obstacle by the water pressure and essentially just held there endlessly. And, if you work out the formula of PSI and the number of square inches that your body has, it does not take that much pressure to equal thousands of pounds of force on your body. So the water can be hitting at, 20 PSI, which is not an incredible amount of force, but spread out, over hundreds of inches of body surface, you're not moving.
Well, think of a little individual water molecule. That's what we're looking at. It's not just one big push. You've got all these little individual components within the water hitting you at once.
Mm-hmm. And if you've ever crossed a stream or, a smaller river, it can be knee deep. But there's, even though there's not a lot of surface area in the water there, there's a significant amount of force. You can be swept off your feet ankle deep. Put your whole body in that, press it against a wall, and the force is significant. So strainers are a major problem, and often in class five, there will be some sort of wood or obstacle where you need to get from left to right before the strainer comes along, or you will die. So,
wow. And tell me how beginners get into rafting.
I'd say, in this area, most people get into rafting through a commercial guided trip of some sort. You go to Jackson Hole and you pay a company $50 to spend 3 hours going down the Alpine Canyon of the Snake River. Or you go to Boise and you go down the Payette River. Or you go to me at the City of Pocatello. We're not a commercially guided trip, but we offer basically an experience. So you come to us and you share in the cost of a trip. And we rent equipment together, we travel there together, and we go all together. It's not a guided trip where somebody's yelling at you to, okay, we're going to be here at 11, we're going to do this, and we're going to do this, but we get together and decide what to do together and do kind of an introduction that way. The more experienced people tend to have a louder voice in the decisions, but the group together is deciding what to go, and we call that common adventure.
Well, I'm curious about what you see when you're out there. Obviously, we're all about nature here and finding different ways to connect. Could you run us through what a typical day is like out on the water and the things that you experience and see?
Yeah, so Idaho is unique in that we have, a lot of places have what we call day trips, where you're on the water for 3, 4, 5 hours, you're at the car at the top and the bottom, a shuttle company will drive your car around, you'll meet it at the bottom. And that's a typical experience. And you can see, you can experience a lot of nature that way. We lead a scenic river trip every fall from Palisades Dam down to the Conant boat ramp. We're on the water for about 5 hours. We see lots of eagles, we see moose, we see deer, we see trophy homes. lots of fish and fishermen and the different riparian dependent species abound, even though it's fairly close to the road and there are a few houses there. You know, nature finds a way in those sections. Also, Falls Creek comes into that area, and there's a really nice waterfall off to the side that we usually stop at, and you can kind of hike around on it. And the orange and green moss is a pretty classic Idaho photo opportunity. But Idaho's unique in that it has multi-day river trips too, where you go 100 miles, 120 miles, and you're going through a designated wilderness area, and you're not going to see a car, a road, you know, or other mechanized travel for 5, 6, 7 days. Idaho's one of the few places where that still happens because of the Frank Church Wilderness, which takes a big chunk out of the heart of the state. You know, the other one would be basically the Grand Canyon, but the Salmon River system, the Bruno, the Oahe, Rio Grande, there's a few multi-day opportunities, but Idaho has most of them.
Wonderful, wonderful.
So what is your favorite place to raft?
You know, if I had to do one river over and over for the rest of my life, it would be the Middle Fork of the Salmon River. It starts just outside of Stanley, Idaho. So you go to Stanley and you head east a little ways. You go over the Cape Horn Summit, and you the typical entry is at Boundary Creek, which is right below Dagger Falls. Dagger Falls is class 5, so you start right below that. And then it flows about 102 miles until it reaches the main Salmon River, the confluence there. You meet the main salmon, they combine, you go about 2 more miles to a ramp, and then you can take off. So it's 102 miles at class 4 whitewater with about 35 named rapids. Hundreds of unnamed class 2 and 3 rapids. The average gradient, the rate it falls at, is about 28 feet per mile, which is considerably steeper than slackwater rivers. The Colorado through the Grand Canyon's gradient is about 8 feet per mile. So you know it's order of magnitude steeper, therefore faster. And things just come at you with a little more force at that rate.
So when you're rafting the Middle Fork, let's talk about how we go about getting there and then rafting it, because it's 102 miles, there's going to be camping. You know, mm-hmm. Is there any type of permitting, licensings, et cetera, that you need to get before you get onto that river? And then as you're going down, what things do you have to keep in mind when you're camping?
Yeah, there's a whole system built around it. There are 4 rivers in Idaho that require you to win a lottery in order to get a permit for the prime season. The main Salmon River, the Middle Fork of the Salmon, the Selway, and Hell's Canyon of the Snake are the 4, it's called the 4 Rivers Lottery. You go on recreation.gov, it opens up in December. It closes January 30th, and then they typically draw permits February 15th, so you've got a little bit of time to plan. Costs $6 per river to enter the lottery, just for the administrative cost of running a lottery. For $6, you get 4 choices. So I choose July 21st, July 23rd, July 27th, or August 15th, for instance. And they produce the statistics of what people chose in the previous year, so you can try and gauge which dates might be or might not be more popular. When I was here attending ISU, one of my statistics classes as a business student, I went ahead and analyzed the lottery to figure out how to beat the river lottery. It's done pretty well for me thus far. You know, obviously, I'm not going to say any more about that, but it is
there you
possible
go, kids.
To beat the lottery.
Get yourself a college education, yep, so you can beat the lottery.
That's what ISU has done for me, is helped me win the river lottery. The Middle Fork, for the most popular dates, typically around mid-July, the odds can be as bad as 1 in 600. There are something like 35,000 applicants to run the river.
Is there a preference of in-state versus out-of-state?
There's no preference for even in-country. It's just pay your $6 and you have the same chances as everywhere else. On other rivers like the Grand Canyon, there's a point system where if you're unsuccessful then you get an extra entry the next year, you know, up to 5 years. So the people who have drawn or gone recently have less of a chance than people who haven't gone in a while. But in Idaho, it's just 1-to-1. So you would have the same odds as me, whether I went last year or every year, which happens to be the case. So to increase your odds, you usually have a group of people, you know, you get your 10 best friends and you all pick some dates that work for you together. You all enter. When you win a permit, you get to take up to, depending on the river, on the Middle Fork, you can take up to 16 people, I believe, right now. Actually, it might be 20 now. They went up a little bit. So if, for instance, I won the lottery, I could invite my 19 closest friends, and I would expect the same out of them.
So I think, Leif, because it's Category 2, 3, and 4, you and I won't be invited.
Oh, darn it.
So...
Well, so I'm wondering, maybe this is an obvious question, but I'll ask it anyway. So why is there a control over the flow and the volume of people that are going in these river systems?
Yeah, so maybe 10 years ago, I went on a river trip with a older gentleman here in Pocatello, Roger Herrer. He had rafted since the 60s and has seen it all. And when we would stop at a certain camp, we stopped at like a Ponderosa bar, and it's a big, beautiful camp, you know, probably 200 yards of flat camping zone, just a really nice area. He, Roger said, "Well, this is the nicest I've ever seen it." He said, "When I was here last," he had not been on the river for quite some years, he said, "I just remember in the 70s, you couldn't find a place to put your sleeping bag that didn't have a wad of toilet paper under it." Mm. He said, "There'd be 50, 70, 100 people here camping and just leaving their human waste everywhere." And he said, "Then they put in an outhouse, but the outhouse would just couldn't keep up with the demand." And he said, "It's just so much nicer now. Yes, your chances of getting on are much lower, but just the river corridor that winds through the wilderness has a finite number of places to camp, you know, a finite capacity at the ramps to get on and off the river, and nowhere in between to do that. So in order to just maintain a wilderness feel and, to lessen the impact, launches are limited on the Middle Fork Salmon, I believe, to 4 private groups a day and 2 commercial groups. So there is still a pretty good volume of people on the river. About 10,000 people a year get on the Middle Fork, but it doesn't feel like that. And that's the goal, is to allow a wilderness experience and just have somewhere that doesn't feel like a highway of people have come through. The Selway River, the Forest Service up there, has a completely different theory about how the river should feel. They want it to feel like nobody has ever been there for the river runners. So there is one launch per day. 4 private a day and a week, and 3 commercial a week typically. So when you launch on the Selway, you are the only group launching that day. And because you move at about the same pace as other groups, you might only see one other group on that trip. And there's not even a good guidebook for it. There's a map. The camps aren't all named. It is a very solitary experience, and it's pretty awesome.
Yeah, I bet. For folks that are wanting to get off the grid, that must be a treasure to be able to do that.
Well, I mean, there's the challenge of the river, but there's you have to feel honored that you're able to experience nature at its finest, where you don't see other people, you don't see power lines, you don't necessarily hear airplanes. You are right there in nature at its finest.
Yeah, it's an experience that's not available a lot of places anymore. Frankly, when I go on the river, everybody knows there will be no phone calls, there will be no email. It's not even an option if you want to. And I'll be back in 6 days, and you know, we'll deal with stuff then. There's very little human interaction. You know, there was some private inholdings on these Idaho rivers, you know, from back in the day. But honestly, I've never seen anybody at one of those cabins because you have to fly or float into them. You can't drive to your cabin. It just means they're very low usage. And in general, a bunch of them have burned down over the years. And when they rebuild, the Forest Service requires them to either rebuild it exactly the same, or if they want it to be bigger or different, they have to move back off the river so it's not in sight. So a lot of the corridor has actually become more rustic over the years, or a little more wild.
Well, I think, too, it's a good example of just how fragile our ecosystem really is and how even slight disturbances can greatly affect, you know, our river systems. And it's great to see all these rafters understanding that and really respecting what they're able to do here in Idaho.
Yeah, and the rafters are pretty good about it. From August 15th to September 15th is spawning season on the Middle Fork. The salmon come in and do their thing. And the Forest Service actually goes through and identifies the beds called reds, and they put flagging and signage on the bank that basically says you're coming to a red on the left, you know, move to the right for the next 200 yards so you don't disturb the fish off of their spawning beds, because the fish, by the time they reach the headwaters of the Middle Fork, are depleted. They're pretty exhausted, and any kind of additional energy outlay could be the difference for those. It's also true that during that time period, the Forest Service does not reissue the permits if there's a cancellation. So say I won the lottery for September 2nd. Turns out I have to work or whatever it may be, and I have to turn my permit back in. It does not get reissued to somebody else. So the number of users tends to drop during that period.
Interesting. Well, that's, you know, one of our points of interest is to find out how Idaho stacks up, I guess, to other states around the country. And we have almost the most mileage of any state in terms of rivers, which who'd have thunk, over 100,000. Lance, would you share with us how many whitewater miles of river we have here in Idaho?
Yeah, I think it depends on how you slice it, but there's about 3,100 miles of graded whitewater river. There's definitely other stuff that has been run, and you know, kayaks can run on fairly low volumes of water, but commercial grade whitewater, there's probably 3,100 miles. The Salmon River system alone has almost 500 miles of undammed, uncontrolled whitewater. Is the longest undammed system left in the United States, and that's basically entirely contained within the state of Idaho. In 1968, when the National Wild and Scenic Rivers Act went into effect, there were 8 rivers originally listed. 3 were in Idaho. And then the Selway was picked up like a month later or something. So 4 out of the original 9 rivers were Idaho and remained to the day. So
there's a lot to be proud about here in Idaho.
Absolutely.
And, yeah.
It's the river state.
This is the river state, and this is really cool. And we want to thank Lance Clark for joining us today. And to learn more about his work, please visit pocatello.us and click on recreation. Shows are recorded here at the studios of KISU Pocatello. Visit us at kisu.org for questions, comments, and audio for all our programs. Our theme music is by Idaho's very own Sons of Bannock, and please remember to get outside and enjoy the nature of Idaho.